Hello and welcome to the Cinematologist podcast. I'm Neil Fox and I'm happy to be back with you again for another episode. It's another academic episode, second one in a row, which is interesting. We don't normally do two academics in a row, but I think both this conversation today and the last episode with Naz Masumi talking about pouring water on troubled oil, I think are both really interesting conversations about practice, research, archive, and also kind of telling stories about histories that have either been ignored or kind of overwritten or misrepresented in different ways. So kind of engaging with the past in kind of really, really fascinating ways through sort of practice research. So hopefully those of you who are not necessarily academically inclined will still have a lot to take away from this, particularly because today's guest talks so warmly and kind of engagingly about such a broad range of film, and any conversation with her always ends up with sort of a list of recommendations for me and hopefully for you to go away and check out. So today's episode is with Professor Alison Pierce from the University of Leeds. Alison is Professor of Film Studies at Leeds, and you may remember, if you've been a longish time listener to the podcast, that Alison was on a few years ago talking about her work as she was moving into making video essays as an academic creative practice research practice. That was a lot of practices in there, wasn't there? Probably should have worked that out before I said it. And we talked then about her newsletter, The Losers Club, which is a really brilliant newsletter. And we sort of mentioned that in this episode as well. But in the last couple of years, Alice has been heavily engaged in a funded project called Doing Women's Global Horror Film History. And I say it slowly to make sure I get it right. And that's what we talk about today, because the reason that Alison popped up on my radar again was because she was the editor of a special issue of the May Journal of Feminism and Visual Culture with a series of video essays that were the sort of part of this project that she's working on. And I really wanted to talk to her about it because the video essays are amazing, and just sort of trying to catch up with the work she's been doing in the last couple of years, seen that it's really kind of rich array of work that I thought would be really interesting for our listeners. And as you hopefully you'll hear from the conversation, she's just a really great person to talk to. She's super knowledgeable, super passionate, and yeah, just really fun and engaging and super smart. So I had a really, really great time talking to her. So hopefully you will enjoy the conversation. It's a quick intro today because it's a longer conversation than the last couple that we've had. But I did want to mention that, and I did see the film The Last Matinee. Now, that's something that comes up in the conversation. One of the video essays from the May special issue is around this Uruguayan horror film called The Last Matinee, which is a slasher movie set in a cinema in Montevideo in the 90s. And yeah, just the trailer looked amazing. The video essay is a really interesting look at the film through the lens of the production designer as one of the kind of authorial figures of the film. And yeah, just thought that looked really fun and wanted to check it out. And so I did check it out. It's available to rent pretty much everywhere, and it's a lot of fun. Some really interesting deaths, looks amazing, really kind of taps into a lot of fantastic kind of classic cult imagery from films about films, films set in cinemas, horror cinema. There's a really kind of loving homage, pastiche in the kind of positive sense of the pastiche and parody that Linda Hutchin might talk about in terms of complicity and critique, looking at kind of, yeah, putting the film in a dialogue with sort of horror film history and slasher films and final girl tropes and all that kind of stuff. It reminded me of a film I didn't really didn't kind of mention at the time because hadn't spoken to Alison yet, but Night of the Comet, which is a great sort of movie from the 80s about sort of end of the world and a cinema. There's a lot of kind of imagery that just conjures up really nice memories of other horror films, and it's tightly plotted, some interesting performances. Alice is quite deprecating about the script, and I know that the person who did the video essay felt similarly, but it serves its purpose. It's a really fun movie, well worth a watch. I'll put a link to that film in the show notes, and there's also a lot of links in the show notes this time because we talk about a lot of stuff. Alice has done a lot of stuff recently, and there's just so much really, really good stuff to check out, including all of the video essays on the special issue. So please do check out the show notes for a sort of series of links if you're interested in the work that's covered in today's episode. But let's leave it there and get into the conversation, which is a really rich conversation. And I'm really, really grateful to Alison for coming back on the podcast. It was an absolute thrill to talk to her about her amazing work. And hopefully you'll get a lot out of this conversation. So this is me with Professor Alison Pearce. Welcome back to the podcast, Professor Alison Pearce.
Hello, thank you very much for having me on again. And also thank you very much for stressing the professor that I am now. Much appreciated.
You're very welcome. It was lovely to check back in with you ahead of this and see that on the signature. Very well deserved and kind of just testament to the amount of work you've been doing in the last couple of years.
Thank you. And yeah, it feels that way. But there's also a thing that I went for professorship, it was last year when I got it. And in order to do it, I'd agreed to do several things to fill certain gaps on my CV. And even though I'm now being a professor for quite a while, I'm still finishing some of those things off. So, you know, I have been very busy, but continue to be busy for, I think, another 6 months or so before things might actually settle down again.
Do you mind if I ask what some of those gaps were? Because I'm in the same position. So I made professor last year as well. And I have...
Congratulations.
Thank you very much. What a love in it is already.
I know.
But yeah, there were notable... I mean, there still are notable gaps in terms of... So I'm interested in what it looks like at different places.
It was more just extra international stuff that involved me traveling.
Okay.
I like being at home. I like being at home in Bradford. I like working in my little shed in my back garden and going inside and getting under a blanket and watching telly. And I get less inclined to travel the older I get. So it's just been stuff like going to do an international keynote in Europe. I'm going to Japan in a few months to do some work there. So it was mostly stuff like that that involved me getting on planes, which I did already have some of, but you just want to make the professorship so watertight that there's no question. So it was more bolstering it to make it like a no-brainer to promote me.
Yeah.
So yeah, there's several trips acting, which sound nice and it sounds like I'm whinging, but when you've been to North America 3 times in like 4 months, it just gets a bit, and it's all work. Like, I went to Berlin recently for one of these things and had an amazing time working with a film festival, but I took my partner and he had a wonderful long weekend in Berlin doing like a David Bowie Berlin trilogy pilgrimage. And I spent the whole time on a train going to work or working. And I saw like absolutely nothing. So, you know, again, part of my job, all fine, etc. But it was being mostly international things. I don't know if it was the same for you.
No, just a few things that are kind of hard to do at Falmouth in terms of like examining, chairing,
yeah,
and supervising postgraduate stuff. So I was, you know,
yeah,
which I'd like to do, but it's hard given we don't have sort of research degree awarding powers. We have a smaller pool, you know,
right,
and we're bound by external regulations. You know, so there again, those gaps are things that I'm looking to sort of fill over time. But I'm also aware that until they're filled, I don't feel safe being like, oh yeah, this is it now, you know, because it's like, well, that it's weird that pressure's still there, despite the title. It's not a cure-all for the insecurities of academics, I don't think.
Yeah. We never stop being insecure.
Never.
We never stop going, someone's going to find me out.
It's ridiculous.
Someone's going to find me out.
Absolutely ridiculous. And again, sounds like whinging because obviously doing fine. But, you know, I think that thing is like that expectation of what a role is and its kind of specificness to a place and a place's idea of it can often just come up against the things that you just... Yeah, you have to change how you do things. you know, and that's an interesting process to hear you sort of say about, I like being at home, but, you know, but that's the real thing, isn't it? That's how you have come to experience life, and then you're being asked to change it, or expected to change it in a variety of ways. I think it's really interesting.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. It's the work and life balance remains a constant, delicate and impossible negotiation, I would say.
Right. On that note, let's get into it. I wanted to start with Knit One, Stab Two.
Thank you.
Because, I think that kind of touches us back to the last time you were on the show. I think you were kind of working on that, and you were kind of starting this kind of academic journey in video essay in a real kind of way. I wondered what that project gave you in terms of where you are now, because it feels like quite at the time, sort of hearing you talk about it and then seeing the success of it and just the kind of the confidence in it, it feels like a real turning point in terms of, is that fair to say?
Yeah, thank you. So when I was last on with you, it was really about my first proper video essay, which was Three Ways to Dine Well. Yeah. And it's fine, it did really well. But looking back at it, it definitely felt like a first video essay, in that I wasn't particularly breaking audiovisual form. You know, it's a series of clips with a voiceover narration. And when I started working on Knit One, Stab Two, which I started pretty much straight after Three Ways to Dine Well, I started in that mode. So I wrote a script first. I mean, and I had, as part of the script, I had very clear kind of timings for the clips that I wanted to use. And then I'd hated recording the voiceover for Dine Well so much. I just hated it. And I hated hearing my voice back. Like, it really brought me out in hives. So I decided to pay and employ a professional actor and voiceover artist, Tanya Vital, who's done the narration for Knit One, Stab Two. So I wrote a script. Did a kind of live online directing Tanya recording, which was super interesting and felt completely out of my depth, because what do I know about that? But, you know, just pretend you do. And then I kind of went into the video editing after that. And so I'd initially replicated the same kind of process as I did with Dine Well. But what I discovered then in Knit One, Stab Two is that my video editing skills had got stronger, and because I was no longer entirely scared of the effects controls panel in Premiere Pro, that I could mess with it a bit more. And I also discovered things, and I never know how you say it. I call them, in my broad Leeds accent, mogrets, but it's motion graphics templates. And I don't know how you're supposed to actually say them. But yet you could also use Mogrets to provide templates to enable you to mess with the screen. And then I started to realize I didn't have to cut this as back-to-back single clips, that I could have multiple clips on the screen at the same time in different sizes. And because I wanted to use, you know, another ridiculous number of films, I think, I can't remember if it was 77 films in Dine Well or Knit One, Stab Two, but there's a lot of films. And it enabled me to get many more films in. So I started to play with multiple screens and multi-screen options. I found that super interesting. And then by the time I'd finished Knit One, Stab Two, I was completely over using voiceovers. I felt like I'd done everything I needed to do with voiceovers. I'd worked out multi-screen, and I'd really enjoyed collaborating with my partner on the sound design and the original music. And I was like, I want to do more playful, experimental stuff. So it's very kind of you to see it as a step forward. And it definitely was. But I think the end result is hopefully playful and fun, which is what I generally try to do with my work. But it was the process of working through that I feel has really unlocked stuff going forward.
Great. Yeah, and it was kind of interesting in terms of looking at it in the context of the May special issue, which we'll be talking about.
Yeah.
In terms of who's doing the work of the, you know, of who's doing the academic work, but also how do we as people who engage with the work understand who's doing the work? And what I mean by that is it was so refreshing to hear that you picked an actor with an accent, a regional accent, to do that work, you know, rather than, well, it needs to be received pronunciation. Like, it is something that was really intimate, but also kind of the closeness between your work and the form of the work was really, really close. So that was, I thought that was really interesting to just, that was, oh, this works so well, because it's, it feels like the representation is close to the source, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, completely. And I'm really pleased you noticed that, actually, because Tanya, who's a rather trained actor and is a professional voiceover artist, and she's, you know, she's worked in feature films all over the world, and she's originally from Bradford, which was one of the things I enjoy about Tanya. But she can do RP, she can do received pronunciation, like the best of them. So she sent me a couple of samples of different voices that she could do with it. And what we settled on wasn't like a broad Bradford accent, but it was a voice that had clarity and enunciation, but was still clearly Northern, which I was just delighted by. But given that I've also got a very broad Northern accent, I think sometimes people think it's just me speaking and trying to sound a bit posher, but it is Tanya. So,
well, I couldn't tell. So there you go.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, and interesting, because I think our listeners will be interested in the direction aspect, because in the last episode, there was another academic, Nariman Masumi, who had worked with Michael Sheen doing the same thing. He put this archive thing together. So I think in terms of things we might talk about today in terms of practice research, it's interesting to see academics moving into a space where they are taking on aspects of directorial roles associated with narrative work in this new context. Yeah. So it's really interesting to hear.
Yeah, I found the whole thing fascinating.
So you had 77 films, and including two M. Night Shyamalan films, I noticed. Like, his penchant for niching was like, wow, who knew?
Well, like, I know he gets a bad rep, and some of his films are terrible, but I love The Village. Like, I really like The Village.
Me too.
And I think the other one that I think is in there, off the top of my head, I think is The Happening.
It is,
which I'm also into, and I went to see at the cinema and really enjoyed. And I went with my partner, and my partner's like, this film is absolute terrible shite. And I was like, it's not, it's amazing. But I love like, so bad it's good films. Mm. Like, that's, I love all that sort of thing. So I was always going to embrace M. Night Shyamalan.
Indeed. I did want to come back to your partner and the music later on.
Yeah.
For sure, because I think that's a really interesting aspect of it. But so the majority of what kind of the episode is coinciding with is this release of a May special issue of video essays, which are all linked in the show notes. And it's around this project, doing women's global horror film history. Classic, catchy academic title.
Right, can we just pause on that? Because this is what happens when you spend all your time working alone and in your head. So I was like, I want it to reference doing women's film history, which is a really important book. And then I was like, but I want it to be global and I want it to be horror. Mm. So I'm going to just stick that in brackets in the middle. And because I was sat thinking about it, I never actually said it out loud. And then I launched the project and I'm like, well, I have made something where the acronym is DWGHFH and DWGHFH. Like, we never came up with how you say it. And then even if people say it all the way out loud, it's an incredible mouthful.
Yeah.
And so, this is one of my learning notes for future projects, which is actually have a project that you can say in full or has an acronym that you can pronounce, like ISA. ISA will be good.
Yeah. I feel that pain. But I think what was interesting about sort of following the work but seeing this was that the global and the horror are really, really important in there.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that you allude to that in your sort of thing in terms of the Sarah Ahmed references, in terms of like just being explicit about what we're doing.
Yeah.
You know, rather than assuming. I think I was talking about this to someone yesterday. We were talking about practice research, you know, and the battle to get practice research recognized in certain big institutional structures in academia, where they say, well, we are inclusive because we think it's all the same thing. And it's like, but if you look at the data and you look at the focus, you're not interested in practice research because it's not representative. And I think it's the same thing, isn't it? It's that classic, like, not all men thing. Yeah, of like, yeah. Well, you know, and it's like, well, no, actually, the specificness is really, really important. And I'd want to come back to your essay, but certainly it feels like this whole project through your notes has focused not just your thinking about horror,
yeah,
but you're thinking about the global and yeah. the context of who is doing this work.
Yeah.
I don't want to ask you to summarize, but if you know, just like how did you end up with the collection of video essays as a kind of significant output for this kind of larger funded research project?
So this project, so the Doing Women's Global Horror Film History, or DWGWF, it was funded by my AHRC fellowship, which was a research development and engagement fellowship. And this was one of the outputs for the fellowship. And when I pitched it in the grant application, I had two reasons for pitching a video essay special issue. The first one was, because this was pre-pandemic when I pitched it and submitted the application, I was really interested in video essays, but I didn't know how to make them, and I wanted to make them. So it's kind of one of them things, like, if you say you're going to do something, then you'll have to do it. So I said, I want to do this special issue with video essays, so partly because I'd have to learn. And then also, I really like how video essays are an accessible format to people who are interested in critical thinking who are outside the academy. And it makes research and thinking and critique and world building, it makes it all open for lots of people to engage with. And, you know, you and I know that there are plenty of very smart people out there who are interested in all this kind of stuff who aren't academics. And, you know, most of them are probably not academics. And video essays is a really accessible way to bring your research out that isn't paywalled, where you're expected to pay £75 for 24-hour access to a journal article.
For sure.
And it also allows you to express your research in more interesting ways, I think. And then I picked this journal because it's open access, because I wanted this output to be for all the people who are interested in that, who, like, don't have the option of accessing through university paywalls. I wanted it to be open to everybody.
Lovely. Yeah, so pleased that it is. It's an incredible body of work. There's this thing you say in your sort of introduction to the essay, which I'm going to quote directly because I just like it so much.
Oh, good. Thank you.
Redefining where our attention falls as academics is an act of diversifying who we study and how we study. It is not just where the filmmaker is based, it is also the job that they do. And that feels to me like the ethos that underpins the whole of the global film history project, you know, horror film history project. And then there's this really lovely example of an essay on The Last Matinee, the Uruguayan horror film, where it basically foregrounds the production designer as being largely responsible for the visual look of a film, which is still quite a controversial thing in terms of, like, the hierarchy. Well, it looks the way it does because of a cinematographer. You know, the Oscars do this very, very broadly. Like, it's, you know, Oppenheimer and Hoyt van Hoytema, like, it's his. But it's like, well, what if we look at it a different way? And how does that change? And then, and I'm going to watch that film before I release this episode because it looked fantastic.
It's a very good, it's a great audio-visual experience. As someone with a background in screenwriting, and both Tori Potenza and I, and Tori's the person who made that video essay, Tori and I both agree that the script is not the strong part of that, but the audio-visual experience is.
Which again is kind of, it's, you know, I sort of wrote down that these essays are, you know, a radical disruptive practice, you know.
Oh, good. I like that.
You know, because it's presenting theory as practice in a really interesting way. And it's saying, like, this is a valid way of analyzing these films. And you mentioned something there in terms of Tori. It's not just about where the films and filmmakers are from, but it's who's doing the work of discussing that. You know, so where are these academics from? And who gets to present these ideas in this way? That feels, it feels really radical in terms of form, and I love it.
Oh, thank you. And I felt like it sounds like such a simple proposition, but it's still not done much at all in academia. And I came to it initially through my research on women filmmakers in horror film history, because, you know, traditionally in film studies, when we think about filmmaking, we do still default to the director. We do still. And, you know, in horror films, relatively few women have been allowed to take up the directorial mantle compared to men. So when I'm looking for the work that women have done in horror films, I'm having to look elsewhere if I want to find it. And I'm having to look at screenwriting, at editing, at production design, at cinematography, in order to find the women. And then as I was doing more and more of that, I was just like, well, why don't we try and really make sure that this special issue has lots on costume designers, on production designers, on cinematographers. So it isn't just that these are women making these films, and it isn't just, oh, this is a film from Brazil, this is a film from Pakistan, but this is also a woman doing this who is a costume designer and in Bangladesh. You know, like, there's just so many like interesting layers that you get to bring to it then. So I did a lot of work putting together the special issue in terms of trying to get people to look beyond simply the director and to think about what are the other roles that women do, and then how do we study them? And then specifically, how do you research them? How do you study them? And then how in video essay, so how in practice research, how do you make, what is your method? Like, what is your method for thinking about how to display this work? How do you make a case for the work that this woman has done in an audiovisual way? And 90% of the time, there's just no existing parameters for that in academia. The whole, every stage of this project has been invention. Every single stage.
And that's amazing. Like, it's amazing because it brings to the surface the fact that you're reminding whoever's engaging with the work that it's as much about the ways of making this knowledge as it is about the knowledge that it provides.
Yes. Yeah, completely. And that's how I hope people can approach the special issue in different ways. And I talk about this in my introduction. I say you might look at this special issue and you might watch it because you're really into video essays, or you might watch it because you're really interested in horror, or because you like women filmmakers, or because you want to learn about different production roles. And all of those things are valid, but it's just being aware that we can really open up what we study and how we study it. You know, there are a million different ways to do the work that we do and to do the thinking and the research. And it's taken a lot of work and thinking to get through this. But I hope it's worth it. I think it is.
It absolutely is, from an external point of view. But it's interesting to hear you sort of say that, because I think that one of the things I enjoyed about both your essay in the collection and the introduction was that it's very clear from both that you're wrestling with your own positionality in the whole thing, and it's completely part of the work. Like, it's that's what makes it so interesting, I think, is that there's no even a pretense at objectivity, you know, because how could there be when you have to do this work, you know? And that's really kind of exciting, I think, to see. Again, you know, one of the reasons that I like podcasting so much, and, you know, video essays can do this as well, is like, can we spend time with the thinking of something? And it's your thinking through the process of making the work about, well, what should I be doing? Why am I doing this? What's kind of underneath it?
And that, to me, is like, personally, like, my contributors, my, you know, they'll have had different motivations for why they took part and what they did. But a key thing that I want this special issue to do is to have some longevity beyond highlighting the work of these specific women filmmakers in these films. So the how is really important. And as you say, like, I lay out barely, like, as in, you know, completely in the introduction of how I did this project, because I would love people to think about the things that I've been thinking about and then take that thinking up in their own ways. You know, the how we do the work is something I'm super interested in at the moment, and not just from like a meta perspective of like, ooh, look at me, I'm thinking about sinking. But it's trying to think through and invent ways of doing things that other people can then pick up and take forward in their own work. So it isn't just saying, here's the interesting work of this cinematographer from Thailand, but it's how might we study the work of Thai women filmmakers? How might we study cinematography in an audiovisual format? And then knowing that, like, how might the person who's watching the video essay or reading the work, how might they then want to take that forward and do something else? So I think what I'm trying to say is I want this project to be generative.
Yeah.
I don't want it to be a full stop. I want it to be like the opening point where people can go, oh, well, I like what she said there and that made me think this.
Mm.
So I'm going to go do that. Or I hated what she said there. So I'm going to show her and I'm going to do this opposite thing. So
yeah.
I'm looking for it to be like hopefully a responsive like call to action to do your own stuff. So that's partly why I lay the thinking out.
Yeah.
So much because I want people to also think and then go do their own thing.
Yeah. I mean, and I think that will be a legacy of it, and I hope it would. Definitely hope it will. I mean, it was interesting to. I've been reading some bell hooks recently, which was
was
a good thing. But I've been thinking about this idea of like patriarchal thinking, because I think May is a really good home for this project because it allows you to foreground the kind of the intersectional feminism that kind of underwrite, and it is that thing of thinking, okay, well, this is not to denigrate anything that's come before, but a lot of the way stories of women filmmakers have been told have been within patriarchal systems of academic publishing, and they also have taken very patriarchal modes of thinking, which is like, well, let's think of women directors as the filmmakers, as you sort of said before, whereas you seem to be coming at this from a kind of really anti-patriarchal perspective of like, well, it's about not just foregrounding women, but it's about thinking about women in a way that doesn't define them by a patriarchal way of doing things, either in the form or the content. And that seems to be, just from reading again the introduction, the feminist aspect, and obviously it is intersectional in terms of the global cinema, like just in terms of just the backgrounds, the lived experience, the budgets, you know, the opportunity to access to resource, like there's a huge intersectional element to this. But that feels very much like and obviously there is a kind of feminist impetus to all of your work in terms of focusing, but how has that shifted through this, because it feels like it's kind of almost distilled into something much more specific than just the initial kind of excitement and desire to do something different, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, completely. I feel like this project's feminist in lots of different ways. And to pick up what you mentioned earlier about positionality, something that I really tried to think about in this project is, so the whole special issue, there were 30 video essays, and they're all from filmmaking industries and filmmakers from what I use the term of as global majority, which is Rosemary Campbell Stevens. Everybody in the video essay as a filmmaker that is studied is someone who's from the global majority. So that's Rosemary Campbell Stevens's definition to refer to people who are Black, African, Asian, Brown, Arab, or mixed heritage, are indigenous to the global south, and or have been racialized as, quote marks, ethnic minorities, and who currently represent 85% of the world's population. So this was where I felt the gaps were in terms of writing about women and horror film. Not that some people weren't doing this work, but it was a small, small amount of work compared to the majority. And I wanted to work through what the women who were coming from these global majority contexts were doing. But at the same time, I was very, very, very aware that I am a white, middle-aged British woman who speaks English. So you're always trying to negotiate that. So I'm now in a position where, you know, like I'm tenured, I'm a professor, I'm at Leeds University, which is a great university, and I'm quite stable in my career. I got a nice big grant to do this work with. So it's about, say, recognizing kind of the power structures within that and what that affords me, but then thinking, right, so what can this, like, white English professor lady do that is positive and feminist without like just being a big douche about it. It's like a kind of Star Wars thing, like, how can I use my powers for good? And how can I raise up the voices of both the critics who worked on this project and the filmmakers? So it's like an attempt at, like, a double raising up in terms of increasing the skill sets and the visibilities of many of the people who contributed to this project, while at the same time changing and disrupting our expectations around who we talk about and which films we talk about when we talk about filmmakers and horror. And what was really important to me on this project as well is that not everybody who has made a video essay and written the accompanying statement is an academic. There are a large number of people in this project who come from outside academia. They are film critics, or they're independent filmmakers, or they're film festival programmers. And the majority of the academics that are in here are PhD students or early career. So again, it was trying to think about, I didn't like ban people at associate professor level and above. There are some more senior people on it. But it was about what's the most I can do with this. So as part of the project, everyone I took on, there was no expectation they had any technical expertise. There was no expectation that they had any confidence, which was crucial. You can be completely terrified by the prospect of editing. And that is absolutely, you cannot have the faintest idea how to do this, and we will teach you how. So we put together a 12-month training course that was done online for free for all the participants. So again, it's trying to think, how can we improve not only the publication record for these people, but how can we improve their skills and their networking in the community? So that was like another crucial kind of feminist aspect, really. Like making new generations, like, I hate the idea that when you get further on in your career, you become like gatekeeping daddy. And it's like, this is my field now, and only I get to do this, and you all have to defer to me. And I'm much more interested in using my powers to nurture next generations who have many interesting thoughts and ideas that are not mine.
For sure. Yeah, I hear that. Absolutely. And it's interesting because what it does... for me, this project is kind of, it increases academia as a kind of ideological space, not as something which is bound to geographical, historical, infrastructural things. It's like, well, it's taking the idea of, well, what do we want to do? How do we want to think? And then not being bound by those things in terms of who gets to do it. So that's academia for me. Like, I don't see it as something which is outside of criticism. It's a way of thinking and a way of engaging with a variety of different thought.
Yeah. And I think me and you are on the same page there, but sadly, I also think many academics are not. So
no, and that kind of
we're in the smaller quartile here, I think.
But you're doing the work of resistance, which is really important. And that kind of leads me to something which I think was interesting in terms of the introduction, in the peer review aspect of it, or the things, because, you know, I was on the May board for a long time, you know, I've published through there, and it's a great venture. But I think, like many things, there's only so much it can do in and of itself, because when it's out in the world, in order to be taken seriously, in order to do the work of sharing the radical work that's within it, it also has to conform to what external people think is valid. You know, which I think is a really interesting tension in terms of what's the balance between being the thing that you want, but also being able to take that forward and have it embraced, or have it even seen where there's an expectation that it has been through a certain process. So that sounded like something that was a productive conflict for you in terms of the aims of the work, and also how the work gets out into the world in the end.
Yeah, and it's a negotiation. So it goes back to that idea of like inventing everything. So I had to like invent this 12-month training program, you know, the likes of which have not been seen before, that was completely online and accessible to everyone. Who some of my contributors, if we think about GMT as a time slot, some of them were minus 11 GMT, some of them were plus 12 GMT. Like, how do we do this? So you kind of invent that. And then because so much of it is about, for me, was about creating skills, training, networking and community opportunities for these people based all over the world in multiple time zones. How do we put that together? And so I came up with regular kind of drop-in feedback sessions where everybody got to see each other's work. But I purposefully didn't want to be there. And I didn't, not just because like it was one less thing to do, but also the other people that I'd hired to tutor into this program, they weren't there either. And I hired Evelyn Kreutzer, who's a brilliant postdoc and a very well-known video essayist. And Evelyn ran those sessions as flat hierarchy, like there are no hierarchies, flat structures is what I'm trying to say. And it isn't about having the person looking over your shoulder to say that's good, that's bad. It's about just doing it and kind of peer review. And I really try to essentially decimate traditional structures all the way through it. But even then, when we get, which gets to your point, which is when we get to the journal, like to be recognized as a credible academic journal, the journal itself does need you to go through multiple peer review. And I had no problems with the journal. They were absolutely great. But the onus was very much on me to find the peer reviewers and to make sure it went through peer review. So it was a credible and recognized academic publication, which is the first. And again, they didn't push this. Like, it's just part of the process. The journal was fantastic. But it's recognizing that even though I've like broken all these things about training and about who we study and how we study and flat structures, when it comes down to it, it still has to go through peer review, and it's someone saying, here are my thoughts on what you can improve. So it's always, and I, as you say, I talk about it in the introduction, it's always a process of negotiation, I think, trying to work out where you can break things and where you can, or you could break them, but it will be detrimental.
Exactly, yeah. Where is that tension going to sort of bear fruit? And it's interesting because it's also about not looking at things in totality and understanding, you know, like, well, if we can't do everything, then it's a failure. It's like, no, actually, we move the needle a bit, which is what I love again, is like, that's what the work is doing. It's saying, well, let's not look at these in totality. Let's look at it in a variety of different ways so that we can start to bring forth aspects which have been neglected when thinking in totality, which, you know, this is something I talk a lot about with students in terms of, you know, if you look at even the careers of women directors, you know, if we take the narrative feature film as the total and the ultimate, then it excludes 95% of the people who've women directors, because they've not had access to that space, you know. So we need to rethink this stuff.
Yeah. And that's what it's really important in the special issue that we've got, is that a number of the case studies are on short film. That's really important. So like, for example, Alicia Issa Rudin's piece is on Amanda Nell Yu, who has since made a feature film called Tiger Stripes, which is excellent. But she's actually studying her short film, the 2017 Malaysian film, It's Easier to Raise Cattle. And there were a number of short film case studies all the way through. And there were a number of really low budget case studies as well, which was also super important to me, because I want people to know about the women who couldn't get in the main system or didn't want to get in the main system. And they were like, screw it, I'm going to do it anyway for like, you know, 50 quid and my friend's help. You know, they're all part of our film history. So it was recognizing that the commercial narrative feature film is not the be-all and end-all.
No, and it's funny. It's funny because, I mean, even here you say that, I'm like, I love John Cassavetes' work, but he's lauded as someone who did exactly that. You know, I'm not going to do it this way. I'm going to do it my way. And it's seen as this kind of, but when women do it,
yeah,
it's not seen that way.
No.
Which tells us everything we already know about sexism.
Yes. But sad.
Which brings me to the subject of your piece, which kind of sits as a bridge, I think, between the project and the outputs that you kind of share space with, which is this, yeah, brilliant kind of engagement with Sarah Ahmed's How Not to Abuse, which is just, you know, any engagement with Sarah Ahmed is welcome.
Always.
Generally.
Yeah.
but just, yeah, this idea of, you know, how not to reproduce what we inherit, you know, which I think just is such a beautiful kind of ethos that runs through the work. So, yeah, like, was that always going to be the focus of your work, or was that something that came out of this process of putting all of this together?
I was being a classic editor for this special issue, by which I mean I cracked the whip on everyone in terms of deadlines and submission while having not even begun to think about my own work, which, you know, classic editorial practice. So it wasn't until everyone's pieces were in and had been through peer review and revised, and I was like, shit, I better go on my own if I want to put something in here. And it was literally, I'd had a realization, I think it was like May 2023. I was like, oh God, if I actually want to publish in this, my own special issue, I better do this. And it's one of the things I like about doing kind of edited collections. So it was the same with my book, Women Make Horror. You learn so much through collaborating with other people. Hmm. And one of the things that I really like about this special issue is the very wide variety of ways to do a video essay. So some traditional kind of voiceover ones that are absolutely beautiful. There are some incredibly experimental pieces. So in it, one of my very favourite pieces is Amy Neese's piece called Splitting, which is on Shehnaz Begum, who's the director of The Cat Beast, this 1997 Pakistani Pashto trash film. And Amy's piece is incredibly experimental and completely blew me away. And then at the same time, there's also a piece by an independent filmmaker based in Beijing called Quan Zan. And Quan did this piece on Mizuki Yoko, who's the writer of Kwaidan, the 1964 Japanese film. And Quan's like this genius with tech, and she used AI to kind of drag hundreds and hundreds of images of young pretty women, and she superimposes them over the faces of the guy in Kwaidan, in the clip that she's using. And stuff like that just completely, like, split my head open for, like, what video essays could be.
Oh, no.
And I will never be as good as Quan. Like, technically, like, I will never be able to do that. But, like, Quan's work, Amy's work, and also the work of one of the other contributors, Birdie, who made an amazing piece on Yang Chai-yun, who's a Taiwanese film director from the 80s. Birdie's piece really showed me the possibilities of what videographic criticism can be, and it made me want to experiment more. So I waited till everybody's was in. I kind of looked through and realised the full remit of the, not all the ways, but the very many variable ways to do like practice research. And then I was like, what am I going to do? And I knew I wanted to include a short film and a feature length film from every region that is studied in the special issue. So, you know, from Africa, from Latin America, from South Asia, Southeast Asia. I wanted to include a short and a horror film with a woman who had a major production role on each of them. But I also knew I wanted to do something short. And Knitwin Stab 2 is nearly 10 minutes, which is relatively long for a video essay. Dime Well is your classic first video essay at 22 minutes. And I wanted to make something really short in under 3 minutes. And it's like, well, I've got 5 regions and I'm going to have like at least 10 films. What can I do? And so I also, again, inspired particularly by like Amy Quan and Birdie, I really wanted to play with the experimental. I didn't want a voiceover, and I wanted to put images and sound together and see what happened. It's what Catherine Grant, I think, refers to as thinking on the timeline, which was something that had taken me a lot. But I was like, what happens when I mush everything together, and how does it make me feel, and what does the experience feel like? at the same time, I'm a huge paid up star. I'm a fangirl. I recently had a video essay published called The Language of Rage, which is another homage to Sara Ahmed. But I knew that I wanted to use her book on being included, which is racism in the academy. And it felt so pertinent to this project, but I didn't know what I was going to do with it. I'd already read it like 18 months before that and underlined it. So I'd pulled all my images onto the timeline. I'd started messing about with them and playing with opacity and seeing, I don't want to multi-screen it like Knit One Stab Two. I want to do something where they all fade in and out of each other, like collages. Very into Dadaist collage and like the women Dadaists like who do collage. That's something I'm very into. And I wanted to play with that feeling. And then I was just flicking through my heavily annotated Sarah Ahmed book on being included. And this quote that I've got on how not to reproduce what we inherit is like 3/4 of the way through the book, halfway down a paragraph. It's not like one of the big lines, but I just looked at it and I was like, yes, this is the thing that needs to appear as text, because this is not just this video essay. This idea of how not to reproduce what we inherit speaks to everything that I personally am trying to do with this project. And again, I wouldn't speak for my other 29 contributors, but it's everything that I'm trying to do on so many levels. And so it was just like a lovely, happy, creative play of mashing together all these things and playing with it till it felt like it made something and made sense to me, I think. And it was a very simple, like Knit One Stab Two took me a year, Dying Well took about 18 months all in all, and I did this one relatively quickly because it's like it finally clicked. It's like it'd been waiting in my brain for so long to come together, and I needed to wait for everybody's work to be finished, and I needed to sit there on the timeline and think, what am I trying to do? And then it all just but it doesn't always work like that, sadly. It's usually a lot harder.
Well, I think, enough often the labour is felt in the outcome anyway. And I think that there's an intellectual labour in your piece, which is matched by a kind of effortlessness of,
thank you,
this is how it should be kind of thing, which is really lovely.
The actual video essay might not have taken too long to put together, but it is the product of three years of thinking.
It's like the Picasso, the possibly apocryphal thing, isn't it, where he does a sketch for someone and he says that'll be X number of pounds, like in a cafe, and they say, I love this apocryphal story, possibly apocryphal story, where they say, but it took you 30 seconds. Yeah. He said, but it took me 30 years to know how to do it in 30 seconds.
Well, I'm liking this analogy as well, where like I'm being discussed in relation to Picasso. That's like completely fine by me.
I thought you'd like that. Totally appropriate.
Yeah, totally on the money. That's what I think every day. You know, like I am Picasso.
I can see in your background you've got loads of pictures of Picasso.
Oh, yeah. I'll just drop it in. Very good.
kind of a couple of things to sort of round us off. One is, the music in your film is by Heavy Leg.
Yeah.
Which is great. And I love the constant everywhere on all your on your video essays. It's like, buy this music on Bandcamp. Who are Heavy Leg? I think we need to know.
This is so nice to talk about. Heavy Leg is my husband, who is a musician and an engineer, and his day job is engineering, but he's an extremely talented, extremely introverted, shy engineer and musician who is never happier than when alone in his studio room on our top floor, surrounded by synthesizers, creating things. We work really well together because he likes to create in response to a brief or me saying, can you do 60 seconds of tape loops for like 2 days' time? Because I've got to make something and I've not told you about it, but the deadline's on Thursday. And he'll be like, shit. And then he'll go make some. I'll be going, no, that's not what I meant in my head at all. And then he'll be like, so he likes having an initial impetus to work. At the same time, I like having a very talented musician on tap that I can be very open and honest with. So right from Dying Well, he's done all of the original music for all of my video essays. And my favourite one is I tasked him for the Language of Rage piece. I tasked him with doing a 1980s heavy metal soundtrack. So like, nice. It's a brilliant bassist, but you can play guitar and you can do everything. So I'm go this time, oh, I want 90s trip hop. Oh, I go, oh, I want 1980s metal. And nice. then he does that and I go, oh, I didn't mean that. And he's like, but you didn't tell me anything else. And so like, we iteratively develop. But obviously, because we're very close, we can be quite honest with each other. And he likes having a project. I'm in trouble at the moment because I'm halfway through my next video essay. But because it's been teaching term, I've not had time to progress it. And he's like, yeah. I'll seriously, you need to get on with this. I want to finish this. And I'm like, just give me time. I need to go back and do some more editing. But yeah, this is him. And he loves being part of it, but he also loves being faceless and working under a pseudonym. And we had a big launch project in Boston in September, a film festival, and I took him out with me and my research assistant, May Santiago, who's based in Baltimore and is one of the contributors to this project. May was out there working with me at this launch event. And then Paul walked in and May stopped the event to point him out. We were like, this is Heavy Leg. This is him. And he's like mortified and just scuttled to the back, you know, but it was great. I love it.
classic electronic musician.
Yes.
Love it.
One
thing I did want to draw attention to is the Ways of Doing project, because I think...
Great.
You know, because again, it feels very much in line with this. We're not just focusing on different content. We're actually actively thinking about how we do the work. Do you want to just sort of share with us what the Ways of Doing project is?
Yes, that would be great. So thank you for asking. Ways of Doing is like my newest ongoing project. So I was saying earlier that when I put in my grant application, I didn't know how to do video essays. And one of the things I pitched as well as the special issue was to go to Middlebury College in the USA and attend their sound and vision videographic boot camp, which I hadn't been offered a place on at that point, but I just put it in the grant application anyway. I was like, it'll be right. I'm sure they'll take me. And I did, and I got to go to Middlebury. And while I was at Middlebury, I was working with a group of other people who were on the boot camp learning to make video essays. And they were all brilliant, but I made particularly good friends with Lucy Fife Donaldson, Colleen Laird, and Dana McLeod. And the four of us are based all over the world. So, well, I'm obviously in England. Lucy's in Scotland, which is close. But Colleen's on the Pacific West Coast, and Dana's in Montreal. And we've always worked together ever since Middlebury, and we've done various events and workshops, but we're very much aware at the moment of kind of pushing at the limits of what the typical kind of video essay is about and how it's done. So we want to move beyond that to think about what are feminist practices for citing people. How can we create communities that are based on like care and respect and inclusion? And we're just trying to move forward by thinking about what does feminist thinking look like for videographic work, and how can we do it? So it's like Ways of Doing is a play on Ways of Seeing, but it's the hands-on doing that we're interested in.
Yeah.
And one of the things we've got lots of stuff in the pipeline that we need funding for, which is coming. But one of the key things we're working on at the moment is something called Feminist Citational Practices Exercises. We've got more than on our website, which is waysofdoing.com. But we've got more coming up. But what we wanted to do with this was recognise some of the people in the videographic world that we think do some of the most important work. And we want to celebrate and like advocate for their work. So we did an exercise called Found in Transition, Catherine Grant's Dissolves of Passion, which is all about the videographic scholar, Catherine Grant, who is wonderful in so many ways. And we produce an exercise that anyone can do to make their own video essay based on what we see as some of the key things in Catherine Grant's work. And we followed that up with one on Barbara Zeki and her project, which we've called Disreorientating Cinematic Language, and we've produced an exercise for that. So it's, again, it's not just about saying, hey, these people out there doing amazing work. It's about saying, these people are amazing. Here is their work. And if you're interested in developing your own practice, why don't you have a go at this exercise and see what it brings up? And we've had a really good response so far. And so many people have made their own video essays in response to these feminist exercises. And they're up on the Ways of Doing website. I still need to do one of them. I haven't done one of them yet. But the rest of them are all up there. And it's dead good going forward. We find it tricky in that, you know, we work in hugely different time zones across the world. But luckily, we all like each other very much. So it's not too much of a hardship to jump on Zoom to discuss. And we've got great plans for a future project, but we need to get a nice big funding success in order to deliver it. So there is more coming, and Ways of Doing is a really fun, exciting, long-term project that will continue.
Cool. Well, I'm on board. I signed up for the newsletter the other day.
Oh, good.
Which brings me to my last question. Where is the Losers Club?
Right. So last month I went to Berlin to work with a film festival, and I got to meet Sarah, who runs Zodiac Film Club, which is one of my favourite
Sarah. Yeah, we
know
Sarah. Yeah.
And Sarah was like, where's your newsletter? Where is it? When's it coming back? I liked it so much. And I'm like, oh, I know. And Paul, who is Heavy Leg, keeps saying, you really need to do that, Al. You really need to get back onto that. So I'd stopped it last year because I was completely burned out and I had to stop. But I do like doing it, and the people I met through it were fantastic. And it was great to get work out regularly into the world and to get instant responses. And you'll know this with a podcast, it's very different. Like when you release a new episode or a new newsletter, people respond. And you're like, oh my God, you know, someone in Thailand's just read this and thinks it's great, and it's mad. And so different from academic publishing. Mm. So it will come back. I think I may need to get rid of the remainder of these things I agreed to do in order to become a professor.
You mean it wasn't the basis of the application, was just, I've got this amazing newsletter.
I mean, it was just, here's the newsletter archives, what more do you want?
That would be enough, surely.
But it will come back because I enjoyed it. And it also made sure I regularly watched horror films, because, again, you might be aware that even though, like, as a film studies academic who writes about film and thinks about film, it's often hard to find time to watch the films because you're so busy doing admin and management and student stuff all the time. So it also made me regularly watch films. I mean, I watch films, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, no, for sure. Absolutely. It sounds like a hardship.
Yeah, so one day.
But it's true. It's such a hardship. But it's so true.
It's such a hardship. Yeah, it will come back. It is not gone forever. It hasn't, I promise.
I just wanted you to know that it is missed.
And that's what I'm hearing. So that's very sweet. I'm hearing this.
But we have more than enough to be going on with from you for now. Yeah. So thank you so much for all of this amazing work and for bringing all of these critics and scholars and independent researchers to our knowledge as people who enjoy engaging with this stuff. So it's an amazing project, and it's been really nice to catch up with you.
Oh, well, thank you very much for having me. It's been very nice to return to the cinematologists.